You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, July 18th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Stoller on the return of Monopoly. Can Democrats return the party to its trust-busting roots? Also on the program today... Oh. Yes. Repeal and replace dead. After 60 votes, will repeal solo finally die now too? Meanwhile, Mitch McConnell has no more friends. Nobody likes him.
My wife likes me and her. No, she doesn't. And my family, like, what do you know?
No, she doesn't.
You've never been involved in an opium deal.
Are we headed to a Republican crack up and a debt ceiling breach come September? Yeah. Meanwhile, Rex Tillerson to shutter the State Department War Crimes Office because why not? And the reason why Chris Christie's so lonely. Finally revealed because he took Obama's call when it should have gone to Trump. Meanwhile, $5 billion in student loans may be orphaned, ladies and gentlemen. Chain of Title Part 2. And the border wall to have holes or be made of plexiglass so you can see the other side. Fukushima nuclear waste to be dumped into the ocean. And New York prosecutors investigating loans made to Manafort. All this and more on today's program, folks. Of course, a very big day in terms of healthcare in this country. Last night, Senator Moran from Kansas and Lee from Utah announced they would not be voting for the repeal and replace bill to go forward. Moran, ostensibly because of process, more likely because of the welcoming he got from his constituents in Kansas at a town hall. Mike Lee, ostensibly to the right of Ted Cruz's risk pool. What do they call it? Diselective alternative? What is the... I can't remember what the term is. But to the right of Ted Cruz's death spiral proposal. And now Mitch McConnell in a hissy fit. I mean, this is... Make no mistake. What we're going to show you is a hissy fit. Mitch McConnell is so pissed... That, and make no mistake about it, this is a huge rejection of Mitch McConnell. Donald Trump has been on the sidelines for quite a while. There are two people who own this Republican debacle that has fallen apart from a Republican perspective. One, nobody's going to talk about. That's Mike Pence. It was his job to go and be the White House emissary and run this whole thing. Fail. Big time. And the other guy who loses, who's completely humiliated by it, is this guy, Mitch McConnell, who is going on now onto the floor and basically saying, hey, jerk-offs, remember how you voted 60 times to repeal Obamacare. Remember how in 2015, via reconciliation, we passed a bill to repeal Obamacare? We did it in the Senate and we did it in the House. And the reason why it didn't happen is because Barack Obama vetoed it. Well, guess what? You're going to have to take one more vote. And it's going to show what kind of jerk-offs you guys are. I don't like any of you. And this is the way that I'm going to tell you.
I regret that the effort to repeal and immediately replace the failures of Obamacare will not be successful. That doesn't mean we should give up. We will now try a different way to bring the American people relief from Obamacare. I think we owe them at least that much. In the coming days, the Senate will take up and vote on a repeal of Obamacare combined with a stable 2-year transition period as we work toward patient-centered health care. A majority of the Senate voted to pass the same repeal legislation back in 2015. President Obama vetoed it then. President Trump will sign it now. I imagine many Democrats were celebrating last night. I hope they consider what they are celebrating. The American people are hurting. They need relief. And it's regretful that our Democratic colleagues decided early on that they did not want to engage with us seriously in the process to deliver that relief.
Yeah, there it is. And that is basically a note. He said, y'all voted for this before. There's no reason for you not to vote for it now. And the idea, of course, is to completely repeal Obamacare, but not have it kick in for 2 years, which is, let's see if I can do the math. Oh, right after the midterm elections. But frankly, none of these senators have any reason to believe they're going to be able to come up with a solution over the next 2 years when they haven't over the past 7 months or the prior 8 years. And Republicans face only 9, I think it is, 8 or 9 Senate seats. I got to double check that they will be defending in 2018. That number is very different in 2020. And so there'll be more vulnerable Republicans going up at that time. So highly unlikely that this is repeal is going to pass. And then the Republicans are going to have to deal with the fact that they have destabilized the private insurance market enough that some areas are going to be hit hard by this. And we will talk more probably tomorrow about what's going to happen now, because they just wasted 7 months on a bill they thought would take 3 weeks. Because they thought they were going to spend most of their time on tax reform and dealing with the debt ceiling and dealing with the budget. And they got to get all that done in the next couple of months. We're heading for another debt ceiling crisis, folks. And this time, there's no one to put the brakes on. But we will talk more about that as the show progresses.
I hope nobody tells Trump about that $1 trillion coin idea. Imagine he's like on a plane to Ukraine.
That would be great.
I took the coin.
I think I could personally steal it.
Oh, right. That one. Let's just mint it and see what it looks like, and I'm going to put it in my pocket.
Yeah, I just want to palm this a little bit.
My face is going to be on both sides of that sucker.
Folks, you know how much I love Blue Apron. I haven't eaten this well. Really, the past year and a half, I would say, has been the best home cooking that we have had in the Cedar household. Picnics, potlucks, dinner parties, barbecues, good food is essential to a successful summer. And frankly, I mean, I would say all seasons. Now, it's easier than ever to create delicious summer meals with Blue Apron, because for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients right to your door. I've told you guys, I mean, frankly, I was using Blue Apron well before they became a sponsor of the program. John Benjamin actually gave me a present. where he like bought me 2 weeks of Blue Apron.
That's the nicest thing he ever did for you?
Yeah, I think it pretty darn close. Although he did give me, for my 50th birthday, an oil painting of a semi-nude of him. But we'll talk about that another time. Blue Apron's much more appetizing. It's completely flexible. You can customize your recipes each week. Nikki has now been vegetarian for 2 or 3 months. And so we get a vegetarian meal each week. You can choose a delivery option that fits your needs. And Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. We've never had a problem with that. Never. In a year and a half, never. Some of the meals available in July include seared chicken and creamy pasta salad with summer squash and sweet peppers. This drives me crazy. Creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges. Oh, boy. Fresh basil fettuccine pasta with sweet corn and cubanelli pepper. I'm on a diet, and just even reading this is making me... Chili butter steaks with Parmesan potatoes and spinach. Oh, boy. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. I've also talked about Policy Genius. Life insurance can be confusing and time-consuming. I'm trying to think how I bought insurance was just because a friend of mine who I knew upstate, sort of like a cousin, the brother of my cousin, cousin-in-law, hooked me up with an insurance agent. But I'm not adult enough to do this on my own. But I got term insurance back when Milo was born. And I got more when Saul was. Term life. I don't know. For some, maybe whole is better. I don't know. But for me, they said term is the way to go. But I went through the process of checking out policygenius.com. It is the place to go to learn about life insurance, compare quotes from America's top providers, and save up to 40% on your policy. And when I saw the prices that I could have paid... And I bought it when I was younger, when it's cheaper.
Your shoes fell off.
Yeah, my shoes did fall off. Well, I took my shoes off. My socks fell off. Their simple, user-friendly website helps you work out exactly which policy is right for you. It really is easy, folks. And if you have any questions, they have a team of licensed experts waiting to talk you through it. No call waiting, no pressing ton of buttons to direct your call. You get actual customer service. And they don't just do life insurance. You can get health insurance, insure your pet, Kelly, or even protect your income, whatever you need. If you've been putting off life insurance, and folks, particularly if you have a child, don't do this. I know it takes like sometimes like 2 or 3 years for people to realize like, oh boy, but don't do that. Or you want to make sure the insurance you have is right for you. Check out policygenius.com today. You can save up to 40% just by comparing policies. Larry, I know you hear me. The quotes are free. There's no sales pressure and zero hassle. Policygenius.com. It's insurance for the 21st century. And lastly, at my house, Milo's gone for camp, sleepaway camp. So Saul's getting all the attention.
He doesn't get all the attention otherwise?
No, oh. He doesn't.
Oh, you guys, it's impressive. You're balancing it out.
Well, we balance it out, and we got nothing else to do. And so, and Nikki and I at this point are fighting over who gets to fall asleep on Saul's mattress.
Who usually wins?
It depends on how much drinking I've been doing. It's the best way to put your child to bed when you're like pass out drunk.
Come on, Saul, let's carve the mattress.
Just push over. Why did you get the Casper? The Casper, as I've told you many times before, it's an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foam creates an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Here is my favorite part of this. You can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, first of all, they deliver it to you, right? In a box, opens up nicely. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it, unless, of course, if you have kids, in which case you won't be sleeping nearly as much. But eventually, free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. To U.S. and Canada! With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/majority using the offer code MAJORITY. That's casper.com/majority using the offer code MAJORITY. Terms and conditions apply. So, ladies and gentlemen, we got a lot to talk about as we get on later with we talk about no, not at the moment. When we talk about healthcare, but right now we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk to Matt Stoller on his piece in the New Republic, The Return of Monopoly. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Matt Stoller, author of the...
Hey, man.
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I was just going to say your piece in the New Republic, The Return of Monopoly, and asking whether or not... well, I should give the... I guess I should give the entire... It's Return of Monopoly with the subtitle, with Amazon on the rise and a business tycoon in the White House, can a new generation of Democrats return the party to its trust-busting roots? And over the past couple of months, we've had a couple of people on to talk about things like antitrust and monopoly. We've spoken to Barry Lynn and to Kay Sabil Rahman. You synthesize a lot of what these guys have been talking about. But I want to just start with Amazon, which you gave some shocking stats about this Prime Day, Prime Sales Day, and it really just gives a sense of just how large Amazon is. And we've seen this also with Google and Facebook. We spoke to Taplin on I guess a couple of weeks ago. But just go over some of these numbers because they're astonishing.
Yeah. So. Well, Amazon has, I think, something like 80 million people who are members of Prime, their Prime service, which is it's roughly the same number who, you know, own a gun or go to church. I think it's more than people than voted for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. It's a, not combined, but each one of them. It represents, the entire kind of retail infrastructure of the country is kind of groaning at this point. And, you're seeing not, some bankruptcies, but you're going to see probably a lot more. and our culture is being reshaped by this giant new force in American culture, which is really only 20 years old. Every single community is being reshaped by the power that Jeff Bezos has accumulated and used to restructure our way that Americans sell goods to each other.
All right, so let me ask you this. I mean, we use an Amazon affiliate link, and I imagine there's also people out there who are saying, well, you know what? It's really, really convenient. And I mean, so what is the cost of something like this? And we could talk about Amazon, but also, you know, more broadly speaking, you know, when we talk about huge companies like this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, so Amazon's great, right? In terms of, from a consumer perspective, you know, I buy from Amazon, you know, my wife is a member of Amazon Prime. Like I get, I'm not like making a criticism of, you know, people using Amazon. I mean, there's a reason that people use it. The argument, you know, so the point of talking about Amazon is to understand that there has been an accumulation of power in our culture and to look at why that is. Amazon isn't so the way that Amazon and Jeff Bezos likes to portray what they do is as a more efficient, great customer service experience. In fact, Amazon is a political construction. It is subsidized in lots of different ways by taxpayers, and it is the result of changes in our legal environment that allow the rise of monopoly power. Now, we don't notice it as consumers because as consumers, we're in many ways the beneficiary of some of the things that Amazon does. But Amazon has now concentrated power in, say, the book market, which is its oldest market. And what you've seen there is that author incomes have dropped by about 25% or so. It's a company that loves books and hates authors. And what you don't see as a reader is the books that are never written because of this concentration of power. You don't see the books that are worse than they would otherwise be because there isn't the financing to actually do the research for those books. And if you look at the way that Amazon is taking this model of coming into the book market and implementing it across the economy in every nook and cranny that it can, what you're seeing is an incredible cram down of the ability of producers of goods, services, and content cram down of their income and their power, and you know what it's going to look like in a few years if we don't do something about it is a society where everything is mediated by Amazon, and the selection of goods and services that we can get is worse and worse and worse, and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and we as workers, as producers, as authors, as creators, as artists will no longer be able to effectively function.
I mean, in some respects, in terms of how it impacts us as those things, Amazon is still very much the sort of the sowing process as opposed to the reaping process, right?
Yeah, in some markets, that's right. It's mostly, I don't know, it's a good question. And so I guess you'd have to look at it kind of market by market. Like certainly in the book market, it's, you know, it is where it is. I think
right.
It's in the reaping process. In the in maybe like the media market. I mean, Amazon is now the second biggest producer of content. I think by that I mean TV shows and movies. It's bigger than HBO. It's bigger than ABC. It's bigger than CBS. The only one that's bigger is Netflix. So it's in the the sewing aspect of it. But you could look at it market by market, how much competition there is in each of those markets. So once Amazon is able to drive competitors out of business, then it goes into the reaping part of it.
Talk about what Lina Khan refers to as the antitrust paradox.
Right. So so it's actually a play on a book written by Robert Bork in 1978. That book was the argument that antitrust is, as he called it, a policy at war with itself. So by protecting competition, by protecting more competitors, small businesses and things like that, antitrust could sometimes raise prices on consumers. So that's, this was his argument. And that actually had an anti-competitive effect. And his argument was that this was a paradox. What Lina was saying is that this has, actually I have an email from Lina that I can just look up. But what she's saying is that antitrust, the way that this has been interpreted, the way that we have used our antitrust laws since Robert Bork, which is to understand that the purpose of antitrust laws is to protect what he argued was consumer welfare and nothing else, a.k.a. price, low prices. The effect of that has been paradoxically to concentrate power in the hands of a very small group of distributors and retailers and producers. So first that would be the chain stores like Walmart. But now it's in the hands of Target or so on and so forth. But now that was in the 80s when they concentrated power and got rid of a whole bunch of independent retail stores. Now we're talking about further concentrating that power into the hands of just one store, which is Amazon, and is becoming both an online and an offline retailer.
So, I mean, let's talk about this change, because, you know, we've discussed it before here, but it really bears repeating. When the Chicago School, when we talk about like Milton Friedman and Bork and others, changed the way that we look at antitrust, so that antitrust was the goal of antitrust policy, the goal of anti-monopoly policy was specifically to make sure that consumers were getting lower prices, that you couldn't have like price fixing, and you couldn't have, basically that's it, right? We want consumers to have lower prices. And I think for most people who don't spend much time thinking about it, that seems like, oh yeah, what else would the goal be? Tell us what else the goal would be, could be, and then we'll start talking about what it was 100 years ago or so.
Right. So antitrust, the antitrust law laws were created in around the turn of the century. So 1890 was the Sherman Act. I think 1913 or 14 was the Clayton Act. 36 was Robinson-Patman. And these are laws that were political laws. They were intended to structure our markets to prevent the concentration of political power in the hands of a small group. And in the case of the Sherman Act, it was, you know, John Sherman was a Republican senator. His brother was William Tecumseh Sherman, who had fought in the Civil War. Sherman's March to the Sea. And in 1890, he passed a law to protect the republic that his brother had fought to preserve in the Civil War. And the idea was, I think he says, if we will not bear a king of our republic or something like that, but we will not bear a king or an autocrat of trade who can just set the price. And he talked about how the ability of an individual to monopolize a trade, recognized branch of commerce or industry, was a threat to working people. It was a threat to the small business people. He used 19th century language to talk about this, but this was what he was saying. And it was a political threat. And he said, if we allow this monopolization to happen, then what you will find is that nihilists and communists and autocrats will end up taking over our political system. And so this carried through for roughly until Bork, this understanding of the political, this sort of Madisonian checks and balances frame brought into the corporate world, that's what antitrust was. It was meant to preserve a balance of power in the economy. No market could be monopolized or there could be what were called restraints of trade. there had to be competition so that you could choose. If you're a worker, you had multiple people you could work for, so you would have leverage there. If you were a consumer, you had multiple people you could buy from. And if you were a producer, you had multiple people that you could sell to. And the point of our antitrust laws was to make sure that there was competition and that market structure didn't allow for monopolization and a whole host of predatory activities in there. What Bork did, and this was the Chicago school really from the 1950s until today, is they made the argument that, in fact, the antitrust laws, that was Sherman, but that's a whole fake history, that Sherman didn't really care about competition and the political concentration. All he cared about was consumer prices, that the only thing that mattered was not bigness, not power. That was totally irrelevant. It just was a question of could you get a good price for what you were trying to buy. And if you could, it didn't matter if there was a monopoly or a restraint of trade. That wasn't important. And so what he did was he created, it was a very smart strategy. They allied with the consumer rights movement, Ralph Nader, with some of the, with some like socialists like John Kenneth Galbraith, who didn't really like antitrust laws, or Lester Thoreau, early Robert Reich. They thought that the Sherman Act is foolish, and they made the case that we really needed to have big institutions that would compete with, you know, Japanese companies and German companies and deliver efficient low prices, that there were economies of scale, and that because of these economies of scale, that small producers and small retailers were irrelevant and problematic. And what we needed to focus on, the best way to understand whether there was a good system was to look at whether consumers could get low prices. And so they designed a legal regime that would allow that. And they didn't change the laws themselves. They just changed the interpretation of the laws. And so the courts, by and large, accepted this new interpretation. And so what you saw sort of very quickly was the creation of business models or the expansion of business models that were at their heart kind of Bork-style antitrust kind of business model. So Walmart and everyday low prices, that is the antitrust paradox in a business model. And Walmart exploded in the 1980s and 1990s when this was accepted by both parties.
All right.
And Amazon, same thing.
Okay, so let me just back up just a little bit here. So why did a guy like Galbraith and why did a guy like Nader, why were they against these type of antitrust laws?
Well, so Nader is a slightly different than Galbraith. Nader didn't oppose the antitrust laws. He was just he opposed regulation. He believed in certain other Chicago school ideas like the theory of regulatory capture. But Galbraith was a socialist. And Galbraith didn't like antitrust because he thought that big institutions were more efficient. He had run all pricing policy during World War II, and so he thought, well, big business knows what they're. Well, I don't know if he thought they knew what they were doing, but he was like, what we really need is they have these big efficient organizations, and we just need the government to sort of tell them what to do, or right, to actually just buy them. And you know, the government should just make all the steel, and the government should just make all the, you know, basically make everything and own most corporate assets. And he just didn't think that small businesses were particularly important. And he was into socialism. And you know, there's a long history of that on the left, and largely comes from Thurston Veblen, who was an economist in the turn of the 20th century. And Thurston Veblen trained a whole bunch of people, and that's really the dominant, that's really was a dominant theme in the Democratic Party in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s. They didn't call themselves people who believed in Thurston Veblen. They used words like public-private partnership and things like that. But it was essentially the Veblenite model of expertise-driven virtue. You can look at like Google, for example. Google. I'll just finish. Sorry, I'm kind of going off.
No.
But Google's theory of you know, we're a business, but don't do evil, That's a social justice theory of how to organize the world, and they even want to organize the world's information. I mean, that is a monopolistic view of the world, and yet they also say they want to don't do evil is their basic theory. So they're that's part of it. It's like Veblen talked of a Soviet of engineers. This was before the Soviet Union. And that sounds very much like that. You know, you have these great guys in Silicon Valley that are these engineers that just want to do good, organize the world's information for you. So it's a political theory, and it's just embedded in these institutions.
And we should say that it's predicated on the notion that you will have an entity that, whether it's embedded in Google, do no evil. I think they've actually amended that, but I think they're just back to like, let's just more or less, whatever. There's an entity that is going to be able to control and make just, if you will, I guess, that bigger entity, that monopoly.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon, the thing is people want to look at generally, people want to see mustachioed villains behind all of this, but it doesn't work that way. Amazon, Jeff Bezos and people at Amazon, they genuinely think, even when they engage in anti-competitive behavior to destroy their competitors, they genuinely think that their goal is to serve consumers. Right? They really do believe that they're doing what they're doing for beneficial reasons, and I think most people at Google and most people at a lot of these monopolies really do think that they're doing it for your own good. But it's not a fake ideology.
Right.
It's real. And these aren't insincere people.
But it's also, at its heart, it is a one that is just almost exclusively looking at the transaction that makes us a consumer, as opposed to a broader sense of what are the implications of this to me as a citizen? And a citizen, theoretically, with a certain amount of freedom and a certain amount of liberty and whatnot, right? I mean, that's where Bork shifted the playing field on some levels from where Wilson was, where Louis Brandeis was. That was the fundamental shift.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it's really important, if you're going to make the argument about consumer welfare, it's really important for you to build a political structure based on elitism. So the Democratic Party, I guess since the 1990s, really the Clinton administration, has been a party that is organized around the idea of technocratic expertise as virtuous. Right, you saw this all the time. You see, Hillary Clinton would talk about all of her plans. You see the incredible snobbery all over the place within the liberal establishment of the Democratic Party. It's very important if you believe in sort of the Thurston Veblen type of model. If you believe in don't do evil and we'll organize the world's information for you, you have to think that you're better. You know what is good for other people more than they do, and that's what the Chicago schoolers did believe that. And the sort of Veblenites within the Democratic Party also believed it. The people who don't believe it are the, as you put it, people, the Brandeisians, the Woodrow Wilson types, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They were basically the heirs to the populist tradition, the Thomas Jefferson tradition in America, who think that the people should rule, not that the technocrats should work for the people. But you see the tension all over the place in the party. I mean, whenever, the Congressional Budget Office, Democrats talk about how wonderful CBO is and how it's just outrageous that the Republicans would attack CBO, this bastion of virtue. That's it. That's a form of elitism. And that does lead to a natural affinity with monopoly. So the problem that we're dealing with, when I look at monopoly, and you can see this all over the place. You can see it in your cable bill. You can see it in glasses, mattresses, the whole private equity industry, the defense industrial base, antibiotics, whatever, wherever you look, you're going to see concentration of power. But the fundamental system which concentrates power is one that says there are a small group of people who should rule over everyone else. And that ideology is very much baked into both parties right now.
I mean, isn't there, I mean, surely guys like Wilson and Brandeis must have felt that they knew better, right? I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that the issue is less about some type of will to power and more about which value you are promoting, right? I mean, where one is about citizenry and one is about a function of citizens, which is to function as a consumer.
I'm sorry. So can you repeat, like, I'm not sure I understand your...
Well, I guess, you're suggesting that it the line here is between those who think they know better and those who don't. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that it seems to me the demarcation is between those who perceive the ultimate value to be our role as a consumer in society versus our role as a citizen. Because as a citizen, the values of politics become far more relevant. If we're just talking about antitrust and we're talking about public policy as a consumer, then we have a much more limited portfolio to worry about.
Right. I mean, I think that is the change that happened, right? It's, do we think of ourselves as citizens to be served by these, you know, these powerful entities, and we have the choice of choosing which powerful entity to be served by, or do we think of ourselves as empowered political citizens who engage in can govern ourselves? The reason I brought up elitism is because that is what it comes down to. It does come down to a basic view of what you think of a human being. And Brandeis, though he did believe in expertise, and all of the successful Democratic presidents did believe in expertise, believed very strongly that expertise was a function of learning the facts and not of actually getting a credential and then just asserting weird models.
Okay.
It didn't necessarily cohere to reality. Brandeis thought, you know, look, there are some people that are smarter than other people, but, you know, just like there are some people that are taller than other people, but nobody is 150 feet tall, right? So if God had meant to make our institutions bigger, he would have given man a bigger brain, with his sort of theory. So you could learn, you know, man as a creature can govern himself and can grow into remarkable capacity, has incredibly inventive, but if you give someone too much responsibility, more than they can handle, which is what happens when you have institutions that are too big, then what you'll find is a whole series of bad political consequences, like the ones that, you know, a lot of the ones that we're seeing today.
So
fake news would be an example.
So to just tease out this point, and then I want to go into sort of where we're seeing this revival, hopefully, today. But when we contrast the notion of Galbraith's idea that you can have big monopolies as long as you have a countervailing power, the government, to regulate these monopolies on a issue-by-issue point, okay? So, like, you're a massive monopoly, but we're going to have price controls. You're a massive monopoly, but we're going to have minimum requirements for who you hire and in what locations, perhaps. Versus what? What is the response for someone who wants to who doesn't buy into that way of controlling monopolies, but rather one, you know, that believes we should prevent monopolies?
So, yeah, Galbraith had this notion of countervailing power, which his argument was that worrying about monopolies was foolish because a monopoly would inherently sort of generate an equal and opposing force. So one of the first, he came up with this in the 50s when he made the case that a giant retailer called A&P, and there was a big antitrust suit against them, and A&P was basically the retailer, like it was the Walmart of the 1930s. He argued that A&P was actually just a countervailing power to the power of giant bread companies and giant food marketing companies, and that it wasn't actually that, and that the antitrust suit was foolish because A&P was operating on behalf of consumers. And he kind of expanded this by noting that, well, you don't really, the problem isn't that you have, like, monopolies in, say, steel production. The problem is that, you know, what you need to do is make sure that we have giant labor unions to face off against the giant steel companies and regulatory bureaus from the government to help plan. So big labor, big government, and big business could all kind of balance each other off. That was his notion of countervailing power. And the alternative theory is the sort of the Brandeisian one, and it goes by a number of different names, but the one I like is regulated competition. And what Brandeis thought is, look, let's have smaller institutions, lots of experiments, and the most important thing is to make sure that there's not just a sharing of profit with workers that he didn't think was particularly important, but he thought it was fine, but a sharing of responsibility, right? So that you would have, in a lot of ways, you look at the German system where you have, workers on the boards of companies or unions on the boards of companies. That's the kind of thing that Brandeis kind of liked, which was you would have competition. So you'd have lots of different, say, steel makers that were competing with each other to find better ways of making steel. But you would also have those companies would be unionized, and you would have workers who would have a role in actually making some of the management decisions and actually offering their own insight and their own responsibility, just as management would no longer have to be the only ones to think about innovation in a company. He thought that would be a better way, a more balanced way of having a democracy, because he thought that if you just have a bunch of big institutions, even if you have countervailing power, which I think is like kind of foolish to say that there's natural countervailing power, but even if you have that, even if you have someone who can give you a grievance board and make sure that you make the minimum wage, it's not the same thing as living in a democracy. Your voice isn't really respected, and you don't really have the difficulty of sharing responsibility for the political and commercial decisions in our culture. And what Brandeis really wanted was for people to be citizens, and to be citizens in all aspects of their lives, not just in the political realm where they voted, but also at work. And he called that industrial liberty. Today, we would call it regulated competition or something like that.
And when you say you would have, expressing Brandeis's desires, you would have those things because of the inability of one player in that industry to amass so much power that they would eliminate those things, right? I mean, the idea being if you have 5 steel players or 10 steel players, that they're going to innovate, and they're going to engage their workers there's going to be a better competition or more competition for their workers theoretically too, right? I mean,
that's right. There's basically two. I mean, I'll note that there were two claims that he made. One is that if you have just one, like a small number of big institutions, they're just bad. They're less efficient. So he talked about like U.S. Steel, right? U.S. Steel was the first billion-dollar corporation. It was a merger of a whole bunch of different steel companies. And he noted that when it was merged together and formed, the U.S. steel industry was the most efficient in the world. And that within like 10 years or so, the German steel industry basically captured a lot of the global steel market share, because the U.S. steel focused on volume and stopped innovating. And the German steelmakers continued to innovate. The U.S. steel industry had been incredibly innovative until it merged into one, basically one entity or two or three entities. So bigness is actually inefficient. I mean, he also noted that, you know, there was a giant railroad collapse, which was called the New Haven Railroad. That was a function of the fact that you had the concentration of power over the railroads in the hands of bankers, and bankers don't do a particularly good job managing our corporate institutions. But that was sort of his big argument, which is that this stuff doesn't work. Banker management, concentrations of power, monopolies are deadening forces. They reduce innovation. They're inefficient. Ultimately, your institutions break. And the second main argument was that if you have more competitors in a market, it becomes much harder for those competitors to take advantage of workers, of consumers, of other producers. So you know if you have a bunch of different tech companies, for example, then as an engineer you have a lot more leverage with each of them. Or if you're a steel worker, you know, the same thing. And if you have just one steel company, and he noted this, that like U.S. Steel was basically impossible to unionize because it had so many financial resources and could cross-subsidize if there was a strike at one plant, it had all these other plants where it could just run them a little bit more. And you see this today where like there was a strike against Verizon a couple of years ago, and one section of the company went on strike, their wireline workers. And so Verizon just cross-subsidized their business with their wireless division. So it makes it much, much, much harder to actually unionize a company and much harder for any workers to have any voice in their company, and makes these companies much less efficient.
And I would add, maybe this is just because I just did an interview with Jesse Eisinger that we're going to run next week about the DOJ and they're going after bankers. It's also much harder to get away with law breaking if you're not too big to jail. I mean, we've now adopted largely the Department of Justice has adopted this philosophy that if you got a lot of employees, there's no way that we can actually really punish you because there's too much riding on it. So, and I would also add that I think that the difference between sort of a new version of Glass-Steagall versus Dodd-Frank is a perfect example of one is the antitrust sort of model where you simply create a playing field where you don't allow this type of concentration. The other is one where you supposedly have this countervailing force in the form of a government, in the form of a statute that gets chipped away, and both the countervailing force was not ultimately not there, and then obviously it got unwound. And it didn't affect the development of this industry. So who are the Democrats that we should be looking at who get it, and who are the ones who don't, and what's the tells?
So in terms of the Democrats who get it, I mean, the leader right now is Elizabeth Warren. So she's doing a number of things that are important, but she's given a number of speeches about concentration. She's really just personally interested in the problem of monopoly. She talks about it, you know, privately, but also publicly. She's also just did something which was really quite amazing, which is she busted up, there's a hearing aid cartel. And so hearing aids are incredibly expensive, $2,000 to $5,000, you know, for each ear. And they're basically microphones, so they shouldn't cost that much. And so she worked with some Republicans and Democrats to pass a law that says that the FDA has to create an over-the-counter hearing aid product category. It's going to probably reduce prices pretty dramatically. So she's got substance. You know, she also did a new Glass-Steagall and a bunch of other things. So she's got substance, and she's also been talking about it. Al Franken is an important leader here. He helped block the Comcast-Time Warner merger from his Senate position. He's been talking about some of the tech platforms. And then, you know, there's Richard Blumenthal and a couple of others. In the House, there's a caucus that's being started. The most vocal member right now is a guy named Ro Khanna, who's talked about antitrust in the context of Amazon and Whole Foods. He's doing some interesting work on the defense industrial base, looking at monopolies that are sole source contractors to the DOD, which is And then you've got Mark Pocan, who's going to be a part of it, and Rick Nolan. In terms of David Cicilline is actually the ranking member on the antitrust subcommittee in the House, and he's wrote a really interesting letter on Amazon Whole Foods as well. In terms of the people that are kind of on the other side of this, they're really what you have is like it's hard to tell who is and who isn't. I mean, I think the number one pro-monopoly Democrat is actually Barack Obama. He is a very adamant about how great the tech platforms are, and he's still out there. He's hanging out with billionaires, living a billionaire lifestyle. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him try to exert his power on behalf of concentrated financial power. He did that when he was in office. I think he's going to continue doing that. Largely, the people who are for concentrated financial power don't say it. They just distract on other things. They talk about Russia. They talk about kind of important social questions. They talk about racial and gender diversity. All of these things are important things to talk about, but they're also used as a means of not talking about core political economy questions. So, Cory Booker is kind of the one who's come out and said that, he is concerned about corporate concentration, but he also is really happy that Amazon's buying Whole Foods because his Newark Whole Foods is now going to get better. So that's like that illustrates that he's kind of like on that side. But I think what you basically, the tell is, do they actually talk about big tech platforms or about, do they name a company? Do they name Google? Do they name, Monsanto? Not net neutrality, even though that's an anti-monopoly principle. But do they actually talk about, the big companies that are dangerous and that are a threat to our democracy that are not acceptable to talk about in the democratic apparatus? So, like Google, Facebook, Amazon, Monsanto, and so on and so forth. There's not many Democrats who do talk about them. It's not to say that they're all captured. It's just to say that it's kind of hard to tell. But I have my eye on some people, and I think we'll know more.
And I think it's something, too, that I think the bottom line is that Democratic voters have to educate themselves on this and reintroduce themselves to this concept and understand it so that, A, they can reward those who are talking about it and B, push back on those who are talking the other way. I mean, that's basically what's got to happen. And it's also consistent with the idea itself, right, that we got to. There's a certain amount of responsibility. You get rights and duties as citizens, and part of this is to educate yourself, and is one of the duties.
I think that's right. I mean, the other, there's so many. I mean, once you start to look at monopoly power, all of a sudden it's like the world just opens. The world just turns a different color, and you see it everywhere. So we talk about healthcare, like the healthcare bill collapses, right? Which is good, right? Because the Republican healthcare bill was insane. But we still spend 16 cents of every dollar on healthcare, and no one else in the world spends more than like 8 cents on the dollar. And it's not because we get better health outcomes. It's because we're paying off monopolies in the hospital industry, the Cleveland Clinic, all of these like teaching hospitals, which liberals love. They're terrible monopolists. When you talk about the pharmaceutical industry, which has just been infected with private equity, these are monopolists that happen to have a few drug factories, maybe, or research labs, maybe. You're talking about pharmacy benefit managers. You're talking about urgent care centers. Everywhere you look, you can go into a hospital room, and pretty much every plastic thing in there costs hundreds of times or is being billed at hundreds of times what it actually costs. So the healthcare problem really is a monopoly problem. And you can look across our culture and say pretty much not every problem that we have, but a lot of the problems that we have, from actual income inequality to regional inequality to bad outcomes in healthcare to transportation problems, you can actually pretty much link them directly to the concentration of corporate power.
Matt Stoller, the piece is The Return of Monopoly. We will link to it at majority.fm over at The New Republic. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, folks. That's it.
Al Franken. Sure. Sure. Both endorse my wife, who's the greatest monopolist of all time. Only she doesn't want a monopoly in his contracts for hitmen so she can keep the prices low. Disgusting. But you and the sellout left and the whole Majority Report wannabe MSNBC team will keep shilling. So enjoy the conversation with Stoller. Meanwhile, not a word on the DNC lawsuit. Not a word. Just killed people in Haiti last week. Not a word.
Not a word.
Not a word. Who's Louis Brandeis?
Honestly, like, there was so many things that were mixed into that piece that I love. Like, I'm a big Brandeis fan.
A great book. A great piece, rather.
I read a book in law school. I think I mentioned this. The comparing Frankfurter and Brandeis.
Yeah.
One was a parvenu and one was a pariah. And Frankfurt apparently perceived himself as a pariah. And so he did everything he could to fit in on the Supreme Court. Whereas Brandeis was a parvenu, where he always had one foot out of wherever he was in. So when he was at the, you know, Zionist conference meetings, he was always slightly contrarian. Felt like he didn't totally fit in there. When he was on the Supreme Court, he also felt the exact same way.
Want to hear my Brandeis impression?
Well, I don't know about that. One foot in, one foot out.
Maybe
monopolies actually aren't so good after all.
Oh, there you go. Kelly is back with a pup date. She has a monopoly on all the pup updates, puppy updates.
Hi. I'm back, and I had a great vacation, and I'm really happy to be back, though. But my pup date is that I had, like, a separated area where it was my dog Edie's playpen, and today is the first day she gets to stay out of the playpen, and we'll see if it is
so disaster. Kelly will not be in tomorrow. She will be dealing with the problems.
No, I'm pretty sure she's ready. I gave her some test trials.
All right. We have now footage of Donald Trump talking about how disappointed he is and sitting next to a very stern and disappointed looking Mike Pence.
Mike Pence looked like mother just talked to him, for sure.
Look, folks, listen. There's two things I want to communicate here before we listen to this clip. One is something bad can follow this. There's no, I mean, at one point we know that we announced the death of the House bill. This seems to be a little bit more intractable, but who knows? The other thing I want to communicate with that first caveat delivered is that this is a devastating failure. A devastating failure for Trump and for McConnell. And we are going to be headed into the fall with, and the interesting thing about this is there's nobody who's on their heels because of this. There's no, like, the conservatives aren't going to be blamed. The so-called moderates aren't going to be blamed. It's really just the leadership. And so with the weakened leadership, that means that these disparate groups within the Republican Party are feeling their oats and are going to go full to the mat. So you're going to see a Freedom Caucus between 30 and 40 members who are going to be like, we want major concessions before you get to raise the debt ceiling. And in fact, if we bust through the debt ceiling, they're already talking about putting bondholders first. What does that mean? It means when the U.S. government, now raising the debt ceiling means, look, we've already charged it. We've just got to pay off on our credit card. And you've charged $5,000, but you only have $3,000 in the bank, let's say. So who do you pay off first? Well, maybe you pay off your rent. Maybe you pay off your electric bill. In this instance, what's facing the country is, who do we pay off first? Do we pay off those people who are expecting Social Security payments? Do we pay off people who are expecting Medicare reimbursements? Do we pay off U.S. workers who work for the government? Or do we pay those people who hold the notes, the bonds? Well, the Freedom Caucus is going to say the bondholders, as opposed to the Social Security pensioners. This could get really super ugly, but here is Donald Trump. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Here's Donald Trump lamenting the healthcare thing, and I wonder if he's going to take any responsibility for it. Is he just going to look at it like, this is something that happened over there, and I can't believe it.
I'm into
it. It must be the Hillary Clinton's fault.
She killed people.
So I'm very, I would say I'm disappointed in what took place. It will go on and we'll win. We're going to win on taxes. We're going to win on infrastructure and lots of other things that we're doing. We've won and are winning the war, as you know, on the border. We're very much decimating ISIS. You can see that. You see that better than anybody sees it, the soldiers that are with us today. We've had a lot of victories, but we haven't had a victory on health care. We're disappointed. I am very disappointed because, again, even as a civilian, for 7 years I've been hearing about health care, and I've been hearing about repeal and replace. And Obamacare is a total disaster. Some states had over a 200% increase, a 200% increase in their premiums, and their deductibles are through the roof. It's an absolute disaster. And I think you'll also agree that I've been saying for a long time, let Obamacare fail, and then everybody's going to have to come together and fix it. And come up with a new plan and a plan that's really good for the people with much lower premiums, much lower costs, and much better protection.
There you go. So basically, completely befuddled, no idea what's going on. And one of the things apparently you do in business is you manage expectations. He's doing a very poor job of that, it seems to me. A very poor job.
We're going to have the biggest expectations. Expectations you can't believe.
It's a lot easier when you're promising Russian guys that they can wash their money easily through your luxury condos.
So much easier.
Who would have ever thought it would have been so
much
harder?
We're going to lower premiums. We're going to do everything. Everything. We're going to do it all. And but before we do that, we're going to do other things. And things are going to be done.
People said, can someone be your daughter and your girlfriend? And can't she be hot? And can't she be an advisor? Yes, it can be all things.
We should do the Trump stakes mashup in the fun half.
Yes, we will. We're going to maintain a great tradition of playing other people's funny stuff. Going to take a quick break. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. We will be right back after this brief message. Oh, don't forget, you can become a member and support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you go to majorityreportkickback.com, and frankly, you know, look, individual action, always good, but the bottom line is, I mean, I think this is clear. You need to have government action to stop monopolies. With that said, at majorityreportkickback.com, you will have the choice of using our Amazon link to buy your stuff or our jet.com link. Jet.com, of course, owned by Walmart, but I think this proves the point. Nevertheless, both those links are there. You will notice no difference when you purchase from these entities. We will get a kickback and continue to use the resources from that kickback to promote antitrust, anti-monopoly policies. We'll be right back after this.
She didn't situation.